I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks for joining me again today. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about today, including a closer look at what's being called coronasomnia, a lack of sleep many of us are experiencing during this pandemic. We'll also get the latest on prostate cancer screening and find out about some great heart-healthy foods we can eat. But first, let's start the show the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
So I wanted to take a little different approach this week for our opening interview in the show. I wanted to talk to you about a recent article I saw in the Sunday Parade magazine. It was headlined, "What's That Pain? How to Fight Back When Aches and Pains Try to Wreck Your Life." Thought there was some good information here and just wanted to talk with a doctor about it and see what you recommend to people for various pains that are quite commonly seen by doctors. The first pain that comes up is joint pain. How often do you see that and what do you tell people?
Well, I mean, all of these common pains that we're going to talk about are kind of my bread and butter of what I see in clinic on a weekly basis. So, you know, so starting with joint pain, I mean, I think this is, again, particularly as we start to age gracefully, is a major issue that a lot of people face. And, you know, probably what we'll talk about with all these, so, you know, back pain and knee pain, et cetera, is, you know, to some degree, this is related to lifestyle and particularly obesity, where particularly joint pain in the knees and hips is certainly related to one, consistent, constant use. And then with obesity, I just say, you know, if you're 50 pounds overweight, it's like carrying a kid on your shoulders throughout the day, every single day of your life, and that just causes wear and tear. So the most important thing I always say with joint pain is just really focusing on the muscles around the pain. So strengthening those muscles actually does a lot to improve pain. And as we, again, as we get older, we become more sedentary, or, you know, in this time where we're in a pandemic and at home, we just haven't exercised and move those enough. And so I usually start with kind of thinking about flexibility and muscle strength. So either getting on an exercise regimen. Some people like yoga or something like Tai Chi that hasn't been shown to help by studies. But I think if you feel better doing that, that's great. But a lot of people I'll send kind of as a first pass to physical therapy just to kind of get a look at that and try to build up those muscles. That usually does the trick, particularly if you're dedicated and really follow up with the physical therapy. And then weight loss, you know, that's so, so important to maintain a healthy weight. Easier said than done, and I understand that. But it's, I mean, almost all of these kind of common things I see in the clinic, and every single one, obesity makes it worse.
What about lower back pain?
Yeah, so that's the, you know, a day doesn't go by where I don't deal with somebody with lower back pain. And again, the same thing. What's interesting with low back pain, I think people's most common reaction to that is to kind of not move. And almost all low back pain, even if you have, well, let me take a step back. But, you know, before we talk about the spine itself, almost all low back pain is related to the muscles around the back and strains and tightening of those muscles. And so when you have pain and you stiffen up and you try not to move around because it hurts, that actually causes that stiffness to get worse and really exacerbates the pain. So, you know, really encouraging mobility, encouraging movement is really important. And the signal warning signs where you, I think you really need to be concerned is when, not when you have what we call neuropathic pain, which is kind of usually that kind of electric or pins and needles or numbest type feeling that you may have in your legs or in your buttocks when you have low back pain, but it's really kind of a loss of what we call motor strength. So your muscles aren't as strong as they were, or you can't lift your leg effectively. Those are kind of the more concerning salient signs. But for most people, I'd say 98% of the people I see with low back pain, it's almost always related to musculoskeletal issues, and particularly around the muscles there.
Let's move on down the body to the foot. Do you see a lot of foot pain?
Yep. And again, there are some specific things that occur with the foot. So, I mean, again, if you've had a traumatic injury, that's always, you know, something to look at and pay attention to. There's a common condition called plantar fasciitis, which is the underneath and the arch of your foot is kind of this dense, real thick connective tissue, and that can sometimes tighten up and cause a lot of pain, particularly if, like, when you first get out of bed. So those are things that you know, are kind of not easy to treat, but pretty straightforward to kind of figure out when I see patients in the clinic with foot pain. Almost always, and again, you know, we talk about the foot or the lower back or the knee and their hip, and just remember this is all kind of a continuous process. The muscles that you know, kind of are around the hip start in the back and end up by the knee, and the muscles in the foot start in the knee and end up down by the foot. So everything's kind of linked together. And generally what I see with patients, what I talk about is a couple different things. So if they're having foot pain, I really pay attention to footwear in the sense that a lot of people wear poor fitting shoes or shoes that don't have good support, and they're on their feet all day or they're doing some kind of activity and they're not getting the proper support, and then they'll have foot pain, and some will even go as far as having back pain. So, you know, once I started buying a little bit better shoes that fit my foot well, that had good support, you know, again, I'm on my feet most of the day, particularly when I'm running the hospital, and I would have back soreness at the end of the day. Once I started getting good footwear, that back pain went away. It just is magical. And I'll tell patients this, and they think I'm nuts. I remember this story a couple years ago. I saw a younger female. She was had two kids and just was on her feet all day and having a lot of back pain and foot pain, and they told her, you know, you need to buy better shoes, and she thought I was nuts. And I didn't see her for like a year and a half, and then a year and a half she comes later, she's like, you know, Dr. Buchholz, I still was having pain, and about 3 months ago I bought a better pair of shoes, and I feel so good. I just felt like I had to make a point just to tell you that. So, you know, it just shows you're on your feet all day, you know, invest in having a high quality pair of shoes. It's worth the investment. And then on the flip side, going back to back pain a little bit too, is invest in a good supportive mattress. Some of these mail order mattresses that come in a box are actually very reasonably priced. My wife and I got a king size bed for $750. My wife chronically had back pain. Once we got this mattress, her back pain just went away. I mean, she's had no issues with it since we bought it 5 years ago. So, you know, you're on your feet or you're sleeping is kind of what you do 24/7. So invest to get the right support for both of those activities, because it pays off in massive, massive ways.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. What about headaches?
Yeah, headaches are interesting. So, you know, again, a common thing we see, and I really lump headaches into four big categories. Almost everybody says when they see me that they have a migraine headache, and migraine headaches, frankly, are a very specific diagnosis that really, with most people, the vast majority of people with migraine headaches, you know, is a very, very severe headache that lasts a couple of days, goes away, and then you won't have it for about a month. That's kind of the typical pattern of a migraine. Most people will have one of two things. They'll either have kind of a daily headache, or they'll have kind of a headache every couple of days. It's pretty, it's not debilitating, but it's certainly noticeable. And of those two headaches, the latter one, so it happens every couple of days, almost always are what we call tension type headaches, always related to stress. I shouldn't say always, but mostly related to stress, concerns, very commonly related to poor sleep. And so when I see patients with that type of headache, I really kind of focus on, you know, what stressors are there, how are they sleeping, are they getting quality sleep, do they have good sleep behaviors that induce a high quality sleep. I often look at eyesight, so, you know, if they should be wearing glasses, but they're not wearing glasses, so they're having a strain in focus. Those are types of things that cause what we call the tension type headaches. Some people have headaches almost every day, and almost, you know, what I teach, you know, residents and students as well, is almost always those are related to some kind of substance. And it's not, you know, the bad stuff we hear about. This is almost always Tylenol, ibuprofen, or coffee. Or when I say coffee, I mean caffeine. So, you know, people have classically had a caffeine headache, so they don't get their cup of coffee in the morning. By mid-morning, they start to develop a pretty severe headache, and that reliably comes on. And all you've done is really just develop tolerance and a bit of dependence on that substance. So same thing, a lot of people have tension-type headaches. They start taking something like ibuprofen. You start taking ibuprofen almost every day because you're trying to prevent the next headache. And next thing you know, the headache's really related to the ibuprofen, the fact that you're not getting it, and your body's like, well, where's my ibuprofen? And then the pain starts on. So the answer to that is usually pretty simple, is to stop those and see, you know, kind of go through a detox period. You'll have some headaches, but it'll eventually get better. Last thing with headaches, I just want to say, is kind of what we call the warning sign. So a couple ones where you need to seek medical attention quickly and immediately is what we call the thunderclap headache. So you have a headache that comes on all of a sudden when you've never really had headaches before. It's the worst headache of your life. That could be at least concerning for what we call a subdural hemorrhage subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is a bleeding in your head. That needs to be addressed immediately, and so that you would seek prompt attention. Headaches that are consistent and always there that don't go away, lessen intensity when you take medicine, is kind of one of those more warning signs that you probably should seek medical attention. And then last, if you have any kind of what we call other neurologic deficits, so you have a headache and then you have slurring your speech or problem with concentration, or you have weakness in the arm or leg or somewhere else, that could be a sign of a stroke and again, needs medical attention pretty urgently.
Dr. Buckle, thanks for all your help. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's nice not to talk about COVID for once, Fred.
So it is. It really is.
It's like going back to normal. So thank you.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU Care General Internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll talk about an increase in insomnia. We've been seeing a lot of it during this pandemic. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. On the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. They've dubbed it Coronasomnia, and it's a very real thing for thousands of Americans who are having trouble sleeping these days. Here to talk with us about that is Loretta Colvin. Loretta is a nurse practitioner at SSM Health St. Clair and St. Mary's Hospitals. Loretta, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Tell us about this. How big of a problem is this? What are you hearing?
You know, I'm not sure I have seen numbers on how big of a problem it is, but I will say in the patients that I talk to, it's definitely something that we're talking about more, and it has continued even after kind of the acute crisis of the pandemic in the spring. Now it's becoming a little more chronic for some who are continuing to have some stressors from the changes with the pandemic.
So tell us about those stressors. What are they, and is that the main cause?
I would say stress is probably the biggest cause that I see. And that can be for a variety of things, and I can even, you know, relate to it myself. My kids are in virtual school, so the school for this year has looked much different than it was in the past. Work looks different for me. I'm working from home in different ways than I was before, and that's also what many of my patients are finding. With that becomes a change in schedule sometimes. Maybe you're not planning for a commute. Sometimes that's good. You're actually getting a little more sleep. But for others, it means they're not on as routine of a schedule as they had been. Maybe they're shifting into their natural night owl tendencies, which is biologically what they might prefer. But if they let it go unchecked for a little too long, it can become a problem. And then just the stressors of economic uncertainty. If you have someone around you who has had COVID or has been impacted by COVID, then it might weigh on your mind and cause you to have more things to be anxious about.
Are you hearing anything about anxiety-provoking dreams?
Not as much. These conversations don't always get to me as often. But you do see a change in people's dreams related to things going on. So if people are more anxious about things that may intrude into their dreams, also we'll see dreams change with untreated sleep disorders. We will see sometimes that change for the better once we treat sleep disorders like sleep apnea.
I want to talk a little bit more about sleep apnea in a moment, but first, how dangerous is a lack of sleep to our health in general?
Well, there's concern it impacts a chronic disease and whether it might impact development of disease over time. I think that's an area of research they're still exploring. But we tend to think about it with mental health and the effect on a person's performance more than anything. For mental health, if a person's not sleeping well, then their mood may be affected. That may cause them to have more trouble with things like anxiety or depression. Or it might be the opposite. Their anxiety and depression may be causing them to have trouble sleeping. So there's a lot of overlap between those two. And we worry about how it affects performance for people who are needing to stay awake for work, who are needing to make high-level decisions, who are driving for work. So if they're not able to get enough sleep, we worry about whether that would impact their daytime performance or the performance when they are awake if they work shift work.
Does anxiety and stress affect our circadian rhythms?
Our circadian rhythm is biologic. So our natural tendency to be, say, a night owl or a morning lark tends to be biologic, but there are things that then can override that. So if you're always on a schedule of getting up early, even if you're a night owl, you've overridden some of that circadian preference. And for people who are under high stress and anxiety, then they may not be able to sleep in the way that their circadian rhythm would prefer because the stress is overriding some of that natural biologic tendency.
We're talking with Loretta Colvin. Loretta is a nurse practitioner with SSM Health St. Mary's and St. Clair Hospitals about sleep problems during this pandemic. Loretta, what advice do you have for people that may be having sleep problems these days?
If a person's having problems with insomnia, we have some basic things we always recommend as first steps. One is to stay on a routine schedule. People's natural tendency when they have a bad night of sleep is to try to sleep in to make up for it. But if they do that over and over again, they adjust their schedule so that then they may not be tired at night when they need to be going to bed and they start shifting to a different sleep schedule. Also, trying to manage anxiety, figuring out ways to control what you can control, have other outlets for the anxiety, such as talking to family and friends, exercising more, and if needed, talking to your health provider to see if you need to do more to try to help manage your anxiety. And then also, we want to make sure people keep those basic sleep practices that are good for sleep. Being screen-free during the time you're sleeping, keeping the phone out of the bed and out of the room, keeping the TV off, and being careful about caffeine in the afternoon and evening.
Does drinking alcohol help you get to sleep?
Well, it gives people an initial drowsiness, but it doesn't last all night. So it tends to then disrupt sleep more as the night goes on and the effect wears off. Plus, of course, we would not want to use alcohol for medicinal reasons because of concerns about developing a bad habit with alcohol and relying on alcohol for sleep. So we would want to talk about other things that to do to help promote sleep instead.
If you are stressing out over everything that's going on these days with the pandemic, would it also be a good idea maybe to do your own sort of private news blackout before bedtime so you don't hear bad things before you go to sleep?
Oh, absolutely. And even more than news, other things that upset you. For example, if you and your family are not close, maybe you're not talking to your family close to bedtime. Or if there are other things that upset you, such as getting really intensely into work, maybe you shouldn't be doing work close to bedtime. So there's other things to avoid anything that's going to make you more anxious, stressed, or have a difficulty stepping away and being able to go to sleep. Those are things to avoid close to bedtime and definitely to avoid during the night.
Let's get back to sleep apnea. You mentioned that earlier in our conversation. I'm hearing that sleep apnea can put you at a bigger risk for adverse outcomes from COVID-19. Are you hearing that as well?
Yeah, I'm seeing some of those early reports in the press, which is very interesting, and it has become a motivation for some people to revisit concerns they might have had in the past about sleep apnea, or become a little more responsive to concerns their family and friends and other observers have shared in the past. Some of the things that are concerning for sleep apnea that's been undetected and undiagnosed would be snoring, having disruption of sleep at night, being sleepy during the day, and also health problems such as high blood pressure, diabetes, heart attacks, strokes, and arrhythmias like atrial fibrillation and heart failure. These sorts of medical problems also raise a suspicion of the possibility of sleep apnea in a person also having symptoms.
Loretta, are you getting patients that are worried about using their CPAP machine during this pandemic?
I am hearing some patients with this concern. Initially, when the pandemic started, people were concerned about reports of how coronavirus is transmitted and whether they could, say, transmit it from one person to the other in a bedroom or a closed space. We're not hearing that being a major contributor to the spread of coronavirus. And so we don't want people to take that information and have that lead to them stopping therapy for a serious medical condition. So we are encouraging everyone to definitely be using your CPAP. If you've gotten off of it for a while due to things going on with the pandemic, go ahead and get back on it. If you need help from your healthcare provider to get that to happen, go ahead and schedule a visit to talk to them about it. It is important to treat sleep apnea.
Loretta, what's your main message you want to get out there?
I think the main message for people is if they're feeling like the stress of the pandemic is still impacting them after the acute phase in the spring where it was new to everyone, that's probably a time for them to start talking to their healthcare provider and exploring what options they have for determining what might be wrong and what are their treatment options. There's a lot of different things available to patients, including therapy and self-help, and also medications when appropriate.
Loretta, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. I appreciate the invitation.
Loretta Colvin is a nurse practitioner at SSM Health St. Mary's and St. Clair Hospitals. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll get an update on prostate cancer screening. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. About one in every nine men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer during his lifetime. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Patricia Heller. Dr. Heller is a urologist at SSM Health St. Clair Hospital. Dr. Heller, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Fred.
Talk to us some more about how common prostate cancer is.
Yeah, so, you know, as you mentioned, one in nine men diagnosed with prostate cancer in his life. It is a very common cancer in men and the second leading cause of cancer deaths in American men, only trailing lung cancer. So about one man in 41 will die of prostate cancer. But that doesn't have to be the case. Prostate cancer can be detected early with good routine screening, and we often are then able to cure the prostate cancer. And that's evidenced by the fact that we have over 3 million men in the United States today who are survivors of prostate cancer. So it's something very treatable, and it's important to get the word out to men to get their screening taken care of.
What are the signs and symptoms of prostate cancer?
You know, often there are no signs and symptoms. And again, that's why I'll, you know, keep reiterating that screening is so important. Men may have some urinary issues, but that's rare. It's rare that a guy will have any signs or symptoms unless his prostate cancer is advanced at the time of diagnosis. So we know that most of the prostate cancer cases are silent. So getting annual screening for men who are within the target age group is so critical.
And what are the screening guidelines?
So the guidelines right now are men from age 55 to 70 with no other risk factors should get annual screening. The screening consists of a blood test called a PSA and a physical exam of the prostate. Men who have a family history and African-American men are at higher risk of developing prostate cancer. And typically in those patients, we start screening sooner than the 55 age group. But that's an important conversation for a patient to have with his doctor about what the pros and cons are of the screening and when it should be implemented for him.
And like with most cancers, early detection is critical?
Absolutely. I mean, we know that there are so many ways for us to approach prostate cancer, treating it, and we need to be detecting it, again, because it doesn't often have symptoms, and that's what screening is aimed for in any disease state, that patients who don't have symptoms are then diagnosed because they get screening.
And why is it so important to get regularly checked?
Because things can change. Certainly, you know, we have PSA values that we look at that are normal or abnormal, but sometimes we look at a trend in the number. And without regular screenings, we don't know what's happening year to year. And we might know that last year everything was fine, but then suddenly this year something's different. Or there's a nodule on the prostate gland that wasn't there the year before, because over time things can change. So just like with other screening exams, it's important to have a regular exam to make sure nothing's changed.
We're talking with Dr. Patricia Heller. Dr. Heller is a urologist at SSM Health St. Clair Hospital about prostate cancer. Dr. Heller, how is prostate cancer treated these days?
Well, there are lots of options for patients depending on the situation of their cancer in terms of what we call the Gleason score. That's a very important component of the diagnosis and prognosis, and then therefore the treatment options for prostate cancer, along with a whole host of other factors that are probably beyond the scope of this discussion. But fair enough to say that prostate cancer diagnosis and treatment is a very individualized, patient-centered approach that a patient needs to have a very comprehensive conversation with his urologist about the options. Some of the global overall view of prostate cancer options, some of it goes from active surveillance, which we've employed more and more these days. Sometimes patients get diagnosed with a very low-grade, low-volume, slowly growing cancer that can be observed initially or even long-term. Other patients have more advanced disease and require active treatment. That can be in the way of numerous modalities of radiation treatment or minimally invasive surgical treatments to remove the prostate. But again, it is very individualized treatment and important for a patient to have a very comprehensive, individualized conversation with his doctor.
What role is immunotherapy playing in prostate cancer treatment these days?
Yeah, so we're not really there in terms of mainstream immunotherapy, but that is a very hot topic in urology in general. And I think over time, the research will definitely change the horizon there for prostate cancer. That's usually reserved in very advanced prostate cancer at this point in time. It's not used as an upfront modality for most patients, but it is available in certain circumstances.
So what is it that men can do to lower our risk of prostate cancer?
Really, we haven't found anything in terms of, aside from just having a healthy diet, being healthy in general, not smoking, those things are important. There aren't any truly research-driven findings that we've come across to date that anything in terms of supplementation is preventative or any other, aside from healthy lifestyle, modifications to a patient's daily regimen. But again, I know I'm sounding like a broken record here, but just getting screened, knowing your individual risk in terms of obtaining a family history, asking male relatives about their history, if they have any prostate cancer, and knowing those risks, and just getting checked annually with your doctor.
Dr. Heller, any specific foods increase the risk of prostate cancer?
No, not that we've found yet. There's been a lot of speculation in certain things. But again, just eating an overall healthy diet for overall health is important.
So red meat or dairy or eggs haven't been proven to be a real problem yet?
No.
So Dr. Heller, what's the main message you want to get out there?
Well, my main message is this. Prostate cancer is treatable if found early. Men need to get annual screening with a PSA blood test and a physical exam with their doctor. I know a lot of guys put off going to the doctor, and it's important to remember that screening is the best way to survive prostate cancer if they have it.
Dr. Heller, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Dr. Patricia Heller is a urologist at SSM Health St. Clair Hospital. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll talk about some ways to improve our heart health. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. What are some of the best things we can put into our bodies to keep our hearts healthy? Let's ask SLU Care cardiologist Dr. Michael Lim at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Lim, what's some of the best things we can be eating?
The best heart-healthy diet is rich in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and nuts. These are things that we do a poor job of filling our days with. Fruits and vegetables, for sure. You know, that's the smallest portion on anybody's plate. It's sort of the last in line in terms of our priorities, in terms of the Midwestern diet, you know. And so fruits and vegetables are really good. They should be the cornerstone of our diet, not the after effects. Secondly, we talked about the added sugars, and we need to get rid of added sugars. Lower the foods that we consume that have a ton of added sugars or high fructose corn syrup, keep those to a minimum. Look at what those things are. These are mostly in highly processed foods. I understand we have things like National Donut Day, and donuts really, really, really taste good. And man, they're just a lot of fun to eat. But these are sort of the quintessential things of that represent you know, every once in a while is probably the most we should be eating those rather than a lot. And then the third things are another forgotten food group. What they're called legumes, which are sort of beans and chickpeas and lentils and soybeans. You know, these are also a highly underrepresented group of foods that we eat in our diet. We should be able to easily increase soy and beans as a source, a rich source of protein. In a lot of ways, you can get rid of the requirements and the demands for red fatty meats from a protein standpoint, and replace them with beans and soybeans. And so if you, these three simple things, I think, as far as diet changes overall, will definitely improve your overall health from a standpoint of what you eat.
Do cardiologists give mushrooms the thumbs up?
They do. You know, in general, though, I would say there is no absolute food that will translate into the longest possible life, meaning that you can't. We're talking about everything in moderation and balance. And so when we stressed the three other things before, you know, the three things that we stressed, one from a standpoint of sugars, we have too much of this, and it's too easy to come by. From a standpoint of fruits and vegetables or beans, we don't have enough of this. And they are actually easy to come by, and they're inexpensive. And so, but we want balance, and we want variety. So it you can't just go on an all soybean diet, or you know, just isolate yourself into thinking that just eating this is going to actually translate into you never having a heart attack or a stroke or living for forever.
What about coffee, tea, and alcohol?
Yeah, so coffee, study after study and study after been done, it shows that I think in the majority of these studies that coffee drinking on a regular basis is not harmful from a cardiovascular standpoint. That's assuming that you don't add milk or dairy or fat to that, and you don't add sweeteners to your coffee. So we're talking basically the best recommendation about black coffee. Same things about tea, as long as you don't add the sweetener and you don't add the milk. It's probably not harmful. Is it helpful? You know, if it makes you feel better or it's part of your daily routine, I wouldn't sweat it. And then alcohol. Alcohol is a really, really, really challenging thing, and it does represent, I think, one of those types of things that we can consume which has a double-edged sword to it. Study after study has shown that a glass of wine a day or drinking a low amount of alcohol actually is protective from a cardiovascular standpoint. But everybody has a different tolerance, and we have a lot of different types of people around our area and anywhere across the United States. And so what is low levels of alcohol for one person isn't necessarily low levels for another. And you start entering in that moderate or higher than moderate alcohol intake, now you run the risk of some issues in terms of causing liver damage and potentially increasing your risk for liver cancers and definitely the immediate effects of alcohol, which don't have very good effects on the mind, where all of a sudden accidents and falls and other things can come into mind. So it certainly has a double-edged sword. I don't think that drinking a glass of red wine a day or a beer a day is the absolute be-all, end-all solution. But if you enjoy a glass of wine with dinner and it's one, I think that that's great.
We're talking with SLU Care's Dr. Michael Lim. He's a cardiologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital, about a new study out from the American College of Cardiology on the best foods and drinks to protect your heart. Dr. Lim, what about energy drinks?
Energy drinks. Wow. This is, I think, the major, major, major thing, which is pride upon, sort of marketing advantages that big companies have. They basically say, look, if you sweat or you exercise, which is actually good for you, you can actually be causing yourself harm. You need to replace electrolytes and make sure you don't get dehydrated. This is so far overstated. The best way to keep yourself hydrated is to drink regular water.
What about dairy products? Any decision on dairy products?
Dairy products, also similar to the alcohol answer, double-edged sword. Certainly, dairy has been marketed as a great source of calcium. The United States Dairy Council has put forward those ads of milk and the milk mustache for forever. So everybody's got that ingrained. And if you drink enough calcium or you consume enough calcium, then your bone strength will be great. And then you will not have the same kind of risk, especially if you get older, in terms of osteoporosis and falls and fracturing. So everybody's kind of got that built into them. They understand the good part of it. The bad part of it is that dairy products are higher in fats and cholesterol, and so that might not necessarily be as good of a deal from a standpoint of cardiovascular health. And so there's absolutely no recommendation one way or the other which says absolutely yes, absolutely no. I would go back to my previous recommendation, which is this needs to be done in moderation. And so having some dairy, especially a lower fat dairy intake, is probably acceptable. Having too high of a consumption of dairy is probably not. Somewhere in there is the right balance for most of the questions you can ask me about foods, in terms of, is this good for you? Is this bad for you?
Is vitamin B12 good for cardiovascular health?
Same kind of deal. Most of the time we actually can consume, in a well-balanced diet, enough vitamin B12 within the foods and nutrients, especially if we're eating enough vegetables, that becomes something that's taken care of. So when we talk about like vitamin B12, we open up the door to other vitamin supplements and multivitamins, and should we take vitamin this and vitamin that because it's an antioxidant or it's going to prevent a heart attack and that type of thing. So vitamin supplementation is not really something we recommend in any way, shape, or form. Large study not that long ago that looked at over 2 million people in multiple different studies shows that multivitamins a day do not improve your cardiovascular health. Individual vitamin supplementation, no matter whether it's thought to be an antioxidant or any other type of benefit, has not shown a benefit from a cardiovascular health standpoint. So eat a balanced diet.
Dr. Lim, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Fred, my pleasure.
Dr. Michael Lim is a SLU Care cardiologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you want to hear parts of this show again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.